She wanted to ask about them both, but didn't. The one working cart was rolling out, Murtry and Way at the controls. The big silica gel wheels made wet smacking sounds in the mud, but the cart picked up speed quickly, bouncing along the ruined landscape in the soft rain. "Was there a drop?" Elvie asked.
"Nope,"
Amos said. "Is there going to be a drop?"
"If there is, they'd better get it in walking range. Unless I get another fuel cell up, that right there was our one working set of wheels."
"Oh," she said, and then, "Did Holden say anything to you before he, left?"
"Yep,"
Amos said, still scowling after the cart. "Was it about going north?"
"Not in particular. But I knew he was going someplace in case he could get Miller to turn the fusion reactors back on for us."
"Miller?" Elvie said with a shake of her head.
"Yeah, that's a long story. Pretty much all the cab had for me was to make sure that one," Amos nodded at the retreating cart, "didn't get uppity and start killing folks again."
"He's going after Holden."
Don't know if that makes my job harder or easier."
The big man shrugged and walked into the repair tent. The remains of half a dozen fuel cells were laid out in a thin plastic tarp. Amos squatted beside them, then started arranging the cells by size and the extent of their obvious damage.
"This would be a lot easier if the Rosie could just drop me down a fresh cell," he said.
"You're going after Holden too?"
"Well, the way I figure it, I'm supposed to make sure Murtry doesn't hurt anyone. He ain't here, so all these folks are looking pretty safe. Might as well go where he is. Make sure he don't hurt no one there either."
Elvie nodded and looked north. The car was a small dot near the horizon, throwing up a plume of spattered mud. She couldn't judge how quickly they were going, but she was sure they'd be beyond the horizon soon. "If you get that working, can I come too?"
"Nope."
"Seriously, let me come with you," Elvie said, kneeling beside him. "You'll need backup out there, if anything goes wrong. What if you go blind again, or if something stings you? I know the ecology out there better than anyone. I can help."
Amos picked up a fuel cell, squeezing the casing until the metal bowed out a degree, and slid the internal cell out into his hand. A slurry of green-yellow mud came with it.
Holden was talking about aliens. Like living, thinking, communicating, mind-controlling aliens, Elvie said. If that's true, I could talk with them, document them.
Amos wiped the mud from the cell with his palm and squinted at it, sighing. He put it down and picked up the next one.
"We're going to die here," Elvie said, her voice soft, gentle, pleading. "The food's going to run out. You go out there and you'll be passing through a whole biosphere no one's ever seen before. There are going to be things you and I haven't even imagined. I want to see those before I die."
The next cell opened. There was no mud, but the acrid stink of melted plastic filled the air, stinging her nose and eyes. Amos closed it again.
"You need to get electricity to drive that cart," she said. "If I tell you how to do that, will you take me with you?"
Amos turned his head to her, his gaze fastening on her like he was noticing her for the first time. His smile came slowly.
"You got something you want to tell me, Doc?"
Elvie shrugged. "The alien moon defense grid thing shot down the shuttle with the fusion drive and the drop with batteries and fuel cells in it. But it let the food and medicine come through. It also isn't busy shooting the clouds, even though there are a bunch of organisms living in them that are made of complex organic compounds. It doesn't care about chemical energy inside compounds. You could have the Rosinante drop you a chemical fuel source. Acetylene, maybe. You've got acetylene tanks up there, don't you?"
"Hell, I got acetylene right here. But these here don't run on fire," Amos said.
"They don't have to," Elvie said. "The chemistry deck
has a combustion chamber that runs assays by converting exothermic reactions into current and then measuring the output. It's not much of a chamber, but if you take that out and build a decent-sized combustion chamber, maybe a 10-centimeter surface, you could probably capture enough of the chemical energy from the burn to make the same current coming out of one of those things. We might need to build a transformer to get the amps and volts just right, but that's not actually hard. Amos scratched his neck and rocked back on his heels. His eyes were narrow.
You just come up with that on the spot?
Elvie shrugged. Does that mean I can come with you? Amos turned his head and spat on the ground.
Sure, he said. I just want to know why,
Fias said. Why what? Elvie asked, walking through the main chamber of the ruins. She had two thick plastic sacks of fresh-ish water, potable at least, and a box the size of her hand with protein rations in it. It was supposed to be enough for one person for one day, and it was all they were going to have until they came back to the camp in the ruins. She'd also found a satchel with a wide fake leather belt to strap it closed.
Why you're chasing after Holden again?
Fayez said, ducking around a passing woman.
I'm not chasing after Holden, Elvie said, then stopped and turned, putting her palm against Fayez's chest. She could feel his heartbeat against her fingertips.
You know I'm not chasing after Holden, don't you? Because that's... I mean, no.
Then why? He said.
The organism still dying in Elvie's eyes had lost all their green tinge, but they left the world a little blurry. She felt like she was seeing Fayez through a filter that softened his features, smoothed his skin. He looked like a media star in some particularly unflattering role that involved a lot of mud and not many showers.
Because I want to see, she said. It's why I came out here. It's why I've been spending all my time taking samples and running assays. I love what I do. And what I do is go look at things. Holden said he was talking to aliens, and that he might be able to turn off the defense grid. And it means we're going to drive through the wilderness,
what's left of it, Fias said.
And because I'm going to die, Elvie said.
Fias looked away.
We're all going to die, Elvie said. And we're all very probably going to die very, very soon. And my choices are to go out and look at this amazing, strange, beautiful, ruined world, or else stay in the camp and watch everyone around me die by centimeters. And I'm a coward, and a hedonist, and I'm sometimes very, very selfish.
You know, between the two of us, I always thought of myself as more along those lines.
I know.
Outside, Amos's kludged cart was roaring. The constant burn of the combustion chamber was like a synthesizer stuck on a particularly ragged and unpleasant G under middle C. Amos was in the cab, sitting at the controls. Fayez walked with her to the side of the cart, and then helped her scramble up into the cab. When he stepped back, he had his hands shoved deep in his pockets. She couldn't quite see well enough to know if there were tears in his eyes, too.
Those the supplies, Doc? Amos asked.
They're what we've got to work with.
All right, then. I got the signal from the captain's hand terminal locked in. We got maybe a week's worth of gas, and the guy I'm after's got a day's head start.
I wish we had sunglasses, she said. Or a pizza.
Fallen fucking world, Doc.
Let's go.
The cart lurched once, the tires spinning in the mud for a moment, then catching and lurching again. The rain made tiny dots on the windshield, and a wide, smeary wiper cleared them away. The world before her was a vast plain of mud. She checked Amos's hand terminal. The path toward James Holden would take them through territory that had been forest-like, past the shoulder of a massive freshwater lake, through a maze of canyons that defied any standard geological explanation. She was going to see a world in the aftermath of utter disaster.
but she would still see it. And the state of nature was always recovering from the last disaster.
"Stop," she said. "Could you please stop, just for a minute?"
"You need a potty break. You should have thought of that before we started," Amos said, but he stopped the drive.
She couldn't even hear the electrical motors winding down over the roar of the acetylene-powered generator. She opened the door of the cab and leaned out. They'd only gone 100 meters. She could still see Fayez, even though he was mostly a dark, fuzzy blot. She waved, and he waved back. She gestured that he should come toward her, and he did. She watched him trot across the mud field, looking down and watchful for slugs. When he reached the cab, he looked up at her. She was sure there were tears in his eyes now.
"Chances are I'm not coming back," she said.
"I know. Kind of need to get a move on, Doc," Amos said. "Don't mean to be a buzzkill or nothing."
"I understand," Elvie said. She looked down again. Her gaze met his dark eyes. "Are you getting up here?"
"Is he what?"
Amos asked. At the same moment, Fayez said,
"Of course I am."
Elvie scooted across the seat, making room for him. Fayez climbed up beside her and slammed closed the door. Amos looked at them both, his eyebrow lifted. Elvie smiled at him and pulled Fayez's arm over her shoulder.
"Don't remember this was part of the deal, Doc," Amos said.
"It's kind of like our honeymoon," Elvie said.
She felt Fayez stiffen for a moment, and then almost melt against her. Amos considered that for a moment, then shrugged.
"Whatever floats your boat."
Chapter 47. Baja.
"How's it looking there?" Naomi said in Baja's helmet. She had a nice voice, a singer's voice. It sounded good even over the tiny suit speakers. Baja recognized that his cognition was drifting and shook his head once, sharply. A glance at his HUD told him his O2 levels were low, and he pulled out a replacement bottle.
"I've found the other 5 holes,
he said while he worked at the air intake nipple.
"You were right. 2 are behind a console. Tough to see from that side. But I think this is all of them in ops."
"Machine shop is next," she replied.
"Got one slow leaker there. It's cramped. We've got some aftermarket equipment using up a lot of space between hulls."
"I'll squeeze," Baja said, then pulled out a small metal disc and started welding it over one of the 5 holes.
"She is over the horizon now," Alex said over the channel.
Naomi was sitting in her vacuum suit on the ops deck coordinating the work, so the only way anyone could talk to her was on her suit radio. Baja wanted to ask who she was, but started welding a second patch instead. The tiny red glob of molten metal spun off the bead and stuck to his faceplate, cooling to a black dot over his left eye. There wasn't much danger of it hurting his suit, but it was a rookie mistake anyway. A sign he was tired. The gentle rotation of the Rosinante at the end of the tether made free-floating objects drift toward the walls. He'd need to remember that.
"Didn't leave any presents for us?"
Naomi asked, still talking about the mysterious she.
"Nope," Alex said. "I keep hitting her with our targeting laser when she goes by. A warning.
The PDCs are totally shut down, and plasma torpedoes don't work now," Naomi said.
"Yeah, but they don't know that. Last they saw, I chopped their shuttle into sushi with a PDC burst."
"Kinda wish we hadn't done that."
"Well, do you like one big hole or lots of little ones?"
"Fair point," Naomi said.
"Almost done down there?" It took Baja a second to realize she'd started talking to him again.
"Yeah. Last one going up now.
I'll guide you to the machine shop exterior bulkhead."
Naomi hadn't been kidding about cramped. There was some kind of large, blocky device taking up almost all of the space between the inner and outer hull. A long metal tube projected from one side of it and seemed to run the entire length of the ship's hull like a sewer pipe. On the opposite side of the device, a complex-looking feed mechanism sat. Flanking the central mechanism, and also down almost the entire length of the tube, sat twin rows of powerful-looking industrial batteries.
62%, Exo, Alex said. Dropping fast. And the clock's down to about 12 hours for the barb. If I had thrusters that worked, I'd be wanting to do a burn about now.
I've shut down everything I can think to shut down, Naomi replied. So our power is what it is. I'm trying to come up with a plan for moving working thrusters to replace broken ones and wind up with some semblance of maneuverability. But it's not a trivial problem. We're pretty beat up.
Baja played his suit's light around the space until he found the faintest trace of frozen vapor. It led him to the tiny hole in the machine shop's bulkhead, and seconds later he was patching it with another metal disc. The actinic blue of his torch threw the space into bright relief, the shadows of conduits and thruster housings dancing madly in the glare.
Alex? Baja said as he worked.
Yo!
What is this thing I'm next to? It looks high-powered. Should I avoid getting any hot residue on it?
Yeah, Alex said, then gave a humorless laugh. Please avoid that.
It's a railgun, Naomi said. We had it added to the ship. You might damage it, but it won't blow up or anything. It fires solid metal slugs, not explosives.
Okay, Baja replied. Just about done here. It cost about 300,000 series new yen, Alex said. So don't break it or you bought it.
By the time Baja had returned through the airlock, stripped off his welding rig and vacuum suit, then put everything away, Naomi had replaced the lost atmosphere on the ops deck and everyone was gathered there. She floated near the command console, still wearing her lightweight atmosphere suit, but with the helmet off. Havelock and Alex were across the deck from her, clinging to the combat operations crash couch. The three of them were floating in the sort of intense silence that only follows a heated conversation.
There a problem? Baja asked when the deck hatch had closed behind him.
Alex and Havelock both looked away from him, something like embarrassment on their faces. Naomi did not look away. She said,
We're going to lose the Baba Picola.
What? I have a plan for moving 5 maneuvering thrusters from the starboard side of the ship to port. This will give us close to 60% maneuverability. It'll be enough to keep us in the sky until the power runs out. But we can't do it fast enough to tug the barb out of her descent. She'll start scraping atmo before we're even halfway done. We have to cut her loose.
No, Baja said.
We tried, Naomi continued as though he hadn't spoken. But the damage caused by the shuttle was just too serious. I'm going to call the captain of the barb and ask that your daughter be transferred to this ship. The price is there will be a few others that come with her. Just a few, though.
Baja felt an almost overwhelming sense of relief, followed by an equally powerful rush of shame.
There are 100-some people on the Baba Picola. We just let them all die. Not all of them. But even if we wanted to bring them all here, they wouldn't fit. A full company on the Rossi would be 22. Our other choice is to die with them, Naomi said. Her voice trembled, but her gaze was steady. She knew exactly how awful her words were, but she wasn't backing away from them. Baja found himself suddenly very afraid of the Rosinante's executive officer. But we're not buying ourselves much in the process. With our power failing and running on a little over half thrust, we're getting very close to the point that we won't be able to get to a stable orbit where we can die slowly when the environment system shut down. And, of course, we'll have moved as many of the Barb's crew as we can to this ship. which just means we'll burn through our power that much faster. This is lose, 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 Bajja. There aren't any good choices anymore. Bajja nodded, accepting her statements without argument. She was the expert. But he felt like there was something missing. It itched at the back of his mind. To distract himself, he traced with his finger in the condensation building up on the nearest wall panel. That shouldn't be happening. The atmosphere system shouldn't be allowing humidity to build up like that. But now that he thought about it, he realized that the air did feel thick and too hot. Naomi, running the environmental systems at minimum power. She wasn't lying. They'd run to the very edge of their ability to keep themselves in the sky. "When do they come and how do they get here?" Havelock asked, talking about refugees from the Barbapicola. 3 hours. I want you to go down and escort them. I don't know how good their suits are, but I don't expect much. We may have to haul some Eva suits of our own down to them. Roger that, Havelock said with a nod. An Earthman's nod, tipping the head back and forth, a move totally invisible in a spacesuit. Without thinking about it, Bajja tipped his fist back and forth to show him how to do it right. Havelock ignored him. But thinking about something else for a moment broke the logjam in his brain, and the idea he'd been fumbling toward popped fully formed into his head. Why don't we use the batteries for the railgun? The what? Havelock said. Huh, Naomi said. Not a terrible idea. They're topped off, right? They pull power to keep themselves full when the reactor's on. And we haven't fired the gun, and they discharge really slow when not in use, Alex replied. But they're on a separate system. No way to pull power the other direction without some work. I can work, Bajja said. I'll do it. Tell me what to do. I'll recharge my suit in the welding rig right now. Wait, Naomi said. Her face had gone strangely blank, except for her eyes moving rapidly back and forth like she was reading something in the air. Wait a minute. Havelock started to say something, but Alex grabbed his arm and silently shook his head. We'll pull power off the railgun grid, transfer it over to the main grid, and use it to heat propellant mass for thrust, she finally said. Yep, Alex agreed. With loss at every step, that's really inefficient. Yep, Alex repeated. When we have propellant mass already in the system without moving the power, she continued. Alex, how much acceleration does a 2-kilo slug traveling at 5,000 meters per second give the ship? Enough, Alex replied with a sly grin, that we're supposed to only fire it with the main drive on. Sounds like a thruster to me, Naomi said, grinning back at him. Havelock cut in. The ship is spinning a little after that shuttle strike and all. Won't that make it tough to, you know, aim? It's not a trivial problem, Naomi admitted. We'd need to make sure we fire at the exact millisecond the two ships and the cable are aligned. No way a human could judge it, but the Rosie can if I tell her what we need. Isn't the barb in the flight path? Havelock asked. Right, Naomi said, her voice soft and uninflected. So, the sequence will have to be tipping the Rosie nose down as we spin past the firing point, launching around, then tipping her back, nose up, to keep from spinning out of control on that new axis. Fortunately, those thrusters work. This sounds, Bajja said, pretty hard. Well, Naomi said with a smile and a wink, it's only the most complicated nav program I'll have ever written, but I have a couple hours to do it in. I don't know about you folks, but I'm excited to be part of this plan, Alex said. Let's get going. Bajja watched the clock tick away the hours and minutes to his daughter's death. Naomi sat at her console, rapidly typing. The symbolic language he used to program the Rocinante's navigation systems meant nothing to him. Watching her work was like listening to someone speak in a foreign language, the awareness of information without actual meaning. But he watched her anyway, knowing that she was building a program that might add precious minutes back to the clock, maybe hours, not days. Alex was back up in his cockpit, out of sight, but periodically he called down on the ship's comm to talk to Naomi about her work, so he was apparently following along from his own station. He would ask for clarifications or make suggestions, but his words were as empty of content to Baja as the symbols on Naomi's screen. Havelock had gone below decks to move the emergency escape bubbles out of the cargo hold and up to the main airlock. The railgun plan might not work, and the next step was to evacuate as many people from the Barbacoa as the Rocinante could handle. It was all just delaying games. Try to save the Barb a little longer with their railgun heroics. If not, save a few people by moving them to the Rosie before she fell out of the sky, or turned into a killing jar with 20 more people breathing her air and overloading her life support. But they all did it without question. They fought and worked and devised intricate plans to buy more time. Baja had no doubt that they'd work just as hard to keep each other alive for even a few more minutes. It wasn't something he'd ever had to think about before, but it did seem to be a microcosm of everything in life. No one lived forever, but you fought for every minute you could get. Bought a little more with a lot of hard work. It made Baja proud and sad at the same time. Maybe that was how a warrior felt, standing on ground he knew he'd never leave alive, making the choice to fight as long and hard as he could. Baja couldn't think why "I went out, but I didn't go out easy" was such an appealing and romantic notion, but it was. Looking at the angry brown ball of Illis rotating past on his screen, Baja thought, "You'll kill us, but you won't kill us easy." He took a deep breath and worked hard not to thump himself on the chest. "You okay over there?" Naomi asked, not looking up from her work. "Fine, fine, how are you?" "Almost there," she said. "The trick is that we'll have a lot of thrust coming from one vector and not along our center of mass with the cable attached, and we only have maneuvering thrusters on three sides of the ship. So we have to minimize rotation to port. But we can't use the starboard fore thruster to counteract that rotation because the cable changes where our center of mass is. It's actually a fun program to figure out." "I have no idea what any of that means," Baja said. "Is it working?" "I think it will. Alex agrees. We'll fire in a couple of minutes on the next rotation. Then we'll know." "Great," Baja said. The deck hatch clanged open and then closed again as Havelock pulled himself up into the ops deck. He'd changed out of his RCE jumpsuit and armor into loose-fitting gray sweats with the name Rocinante across his chest. The security officer was bigger than Holden, so if the clothes hung loose on him, they must belong to Amos. Baja thought maybe he wouldn't wear Amos's clothes without asking. "The emergency stuff is in the airlock," Havelock said to Naomi's back. She hadn't looked up from her work when he came in. "I also threw a couple of Eva packs, some extra air bottles, and Baja's welding ring in there. I can't think of anything else we might need." "Thank you, Dimitri," Naomi said.
"Dimitri?" Baja asked with a raised eyebrow.
"You've got a problem with that? Isn't Baja a girl's name?" Havelock shot back. "It was my grandmother's name, and she was a solar system-wide famous physicist, so it's a great honor to be named after her. I was the first grandchild." "You two can shut up or leave the deck," Naomi said. Then she hit the wall comm and added, "Alex, you ready up there?"
Think so, Alex replied with his heavy drawl. Just a sec, let me tweak one thing here.
Can we throw this up on the big screen? Baja asked. I'd like to see what happens.
Naomi didn't answer, but the main screen on the deck shifted from a tactical map to a forward telescopic view. The image rotated slowly past the brown and gray ball of Illus, and then past the distant gray hulk of the Barbapiccola, and then onto the starry black.
Missed our window, Naomi said. You almost ready?
Yeah, Alex replied, dragging the word out to three syllables. Now, good to go.
Executing, Naomi said, and tapped a button on her screen. But nothing happened.
The view on the big screen continued to slowly pan until Illus came back into view. Then, the Barbapiccola. Then, without warning, the Rocinante tipped violently forward, and something very loud happened in the belly of the ship. A bright dot of fire and a curve of flame appeared in the planet's atmosphere. Baja found that the far bulkhead was now traveling toward him at a slow but noticeable speed. The ship pitched again, the various maneuvering thrusters firing in staccato bursts. When the noise and movement was over, the view on the main screen was steady, locked on to the Barbapiccola.
Huh, Alex said. I'm seeing activity from the moons.
Are they shooting at us? Havelock said.
Nope, looks like they're trying to knock down the Gauss round, Alex said. Full points for optimism.
We're not rotating anymore, Baja said.
No, Naomi replied. Give me any three directions of thrust and I can find a way to stop us. Now we just keep it here firing and adjusting and we should be adding some speed to our orbit.
Baja looked down at the timer counting away the Barbapiccola's remaining life. It had added a little over 4 minutes.
How often can you fire?
About every 5 minutes or so, if we don't want to overheat the rails and burn the batteries out. At least every 5 minutes until the batteries are dead.
But we've just stopped the degrading orbit, but not much more, Naomi said.
Israel's coming back around, Alex said. She dumped something off.
God damn it, Naomi muttered. Give us a fucking break, will you guys? What are they dropping?
Men in suits, Alex said.
It's the militia, Havelock said.
He'd pulled himself over to a tactical display and was zooming it in and out.
12 of them in vacuum armor with EVA packs, plus an equal number of metallic objects of about human size. Not sure what those are.
Any speculation on what they're doing? Naomi said, switching her view to match his.
They're engineers. They know how crippled we are, how vulnerable. So my guess is, they're going to try to kill us.
Chapter 48. Holden. Life at the Naval Academy had been so stressful for Holden that at the end of his first term he'd celebrated by going to a party and drinking until he passed out for 24 hours. It had been his first lesson on the difference between unconsciousness and sleep. They might seem the same, but they weren't. After 20 hours, he'd woken feeling totally unrested, and the morning PT the next day had almost killed him. Riding on Miller's material transfer network, it was difficult to get any sense of the passage of time. The first time Holden came to, his hand terminal told him 10 hours had passed. He could tell he'd spent it unconscious rather than sleeping because he felt exhausted and sick. His throat hurt. His eyes burned like they'd been sandpapered, and all of his muscles ached. It almost felt like a flu, except that the antivirals he took every 3 months made that pretty much impossible. He turned on his armor's diagnostic system, and it gave him a series of shots. He had no idea what. He drank half the water in his canteen and closed his eyes. It was 9 hours later when he woke again.
And this time, he was almost rested, the soreness in his throat gone. At some point, he passed the threshold from unconsciousness to sleep, and his body was rewarding him for it. He stretched out on the metal floor until his joints popped, then drank the rest of his water.
"Wakey, wakey," Miller said.
He slowly appeared in the darkness, surrounded by a halo of blue light, as if someone were turning up his dimmer switch.
"I'm awake," Holden replied,
then rattled his empty canteen at Miller.
"But you stuffed me into this cattle car so fast I wasn't able to get supplies. Gonna get pretty thirsty if there isn't, you know, an alien drinking fountain for something."
"We'll see. But that's actually the least of our problems right now," says the guy who doesn't drink. "There's a damaged piece of the system ahead," Miller continued, "and I'd hoped we'd be able to get around it. No such luck. We're on foot from here."
"Your fancy alien train is broken?"
"My fancy alien material transfer system has been sitting unused for over 1 billion years, and half the planet just exploded. Your ship was built less than a decade ago, and you can barely keep the coffee pot running."
"You're a sad, bitter little man," Holden said as he climbed to his feet and pushed against the train door. It didn't open.
"Hold on," Miller said and vanished. Holden turned the brightness up on his terminal and spent a few minutes checking over his equipment while he waited. Miller had grabbed him right after his final patrol around the settlement, which meant he had his armor, his pistol, and quite a few magazines of ammunition, all of which was pretty likely to be useless. He also had one empty canteen, no food, and a suit medical pack that was running low on almost everything, all of which would have been much handier to have fully stocked. When his body finally woke up enough to be hungry, he expected to be quite willing to trade his gun in for a sandwich. He didn't think the alien structures would have many vending machines. 10 minutes passed, and his anxiety shifted to impatience. He sat down again and tried to call the Rocinante on his hand terminal, but got a failed connection message. He tried Elvie, Lucia, and Amos. All failed. Whatever the alien subway was made out of, it was blocking his signals to the hub on the Rosi. It had to be that. The alternative was that the Rosi wasn't working, and that opened up too many bad scenarios. He pulled up a mindless pattern-matching game and played that for a while, until the terminal gave him a low battery warning and he turned it off. After an hour passed, he started to get nervous. He wasn't claustrophobic. He'd spent most of his adult life in tiny cabins on spaceships, but that didn't mean he relished the idea of dying alone in a small metal box deep under the earth. He kicked the container's door a few times and shouted to Miller, but got no reply. Which was, in its own way, fairly alarming. The container he'd been sleeping in during the long trip north was empty. The only tools he had with him were used for repairing his armor and weapons. There was nothing that could cut through the metal or bend it. He kicked the door again, this time putting enough effort into it that it hurt his shins. It didn't move at all. "Huh," he said out loud. If Miller had brought him all this way just to let him die in an abandoned train car, it was the longest prank set up in history. Holden was doing a mental inventory of everything he was carrying, trying to figure out if any combination of things might make an explosive powerful enough to blow the door off, and carefully ignoring the fact that any such explosion would probably liquefy any biology inside the small metal compartment, when a loud metallic groan came from outside the cart that rose in pitch to a shriek. The compartment shuddered and rocked. A long series of powerful hammering sounds assaulted him. Another metallic scream that grew to deafening levels. The door to the compartment vanished, torn from the container in one massive blow. On the other side,
stood a nightmare. At first glance, it looked like a massive collection of appendages and cutting tools. It stood on six of its limbs and waved four others in the air like a crustacean made of steel and knives. Whipping through the air around the heavier cutting arms were a dozen or more tentacles of what looked like black rubber. As he watched, two of the tentacles gripped the inside edges of the doorway and bent them out with fearsome strength. He pulled his pistol, but didn't point it at the thing. It felt very small and inadequate in his hand.
"Put that away," the monster said in Miller's voice. "It'll put your eye out."
Holden hadn't thought much about the fact that every time he heard Miller's voice over the last year, it had been a protomolecule-induced hallucination. But at the sound of the detective's voice in the air, actual vibrations moving through the atmosphere and hitting his eardrums, the strangeness of it made him feel a little lightheaded.
"Is that you?"
Holden asked in what he was pretty sure was the new universal winner for stupid questions.
"Depends what you mean,"
the Miller bot said, and backed away from the opening. It was surprisingly quiet for such a huge metallic monster.
"I'm able to get into the local hardware, and this thing was in pretty good shape for having missed its 3-month warranty check by 1,000 million years or so." Miller did something, and suddenly, Holden could see the detective in his rumpled suit standing where the monster had been.
He shrugged and smiled apologetically. But even as Holden saw a projection of Miller, superimposed over it, he saw the robot. It was doing the same shrug, though instead of hands, it used two massive serrated crab claws. It would have been comic if it hadn't come with a splitting headache.
"One or the other," Holden said, squeezing his eyes shut. "I can't see both things. It breaks my brain."
"Sorry, no problem," Miller replied. And when Holden opened his eyes again, only the robot was there.
"Come on, we have a lot of ground to cover."
Holden hopped out of the material transfer container and onto a flat metal floor. Various sections of the Millerbot's carapace glowed with a faint light, and unlike the blue light that had always accompanied the Miller ghost, it actually illuminated the space around it. Pointing at one glowing limb, Holden said, "Can you make that brighter?" In answer, all of the glowing sections of the robot intensified until the tunnel was as bright as noon. The reason for the material transfer cart stoppage became apparent. A couple dozen meters ahead, the metal tunnel was blown apart and filled with rocks and debris. Reading his mind, Miller said,
"Yeah, not everything is handling the reboot well. Power node for the maglev woke up bad and blew itself up. Only, it's not exactly maglev. Close enough, though, you can get the picture."
"Can we get past it?"
"Well, we can't repair the track, but I can get you out." "Making passages," the Millerbot said, waving one massive claw in the air, "is what this thing's for. They used to dig and maintain these tunnels. Hop on."
"You're fucking kidding me."
"No, seriously, climb on. This guy can move faster than you can on foot."
"Miller," Holden said, "you are made entirely out of cutting edges and pinch points." One of the black tentacles twisted around, looking over the robot's carapace carefully.
"Hold on," Miller said,
and with a hum and a few metallic clanks, the torso of the robot twisted into a new configuration, leaving a wide, flat spot on its back.
"There you go."
Holden hesitated for a moment, then climbed up on one of the robot's legs and onto its back. The Millerbot trundled forward to the damaged section of tunnel, and the four big forward limbs went to work, tearing out the twisted metal of the tunnel walls and clearing the earth and stone that had filled the space. The machine worked with speed, precision, and a terrifying casual strength.
"Hey, Miller," Holden said,
watching the robot peel up a 2-meter section of the tunnel's metal flooring and rapidly cut it into tiny pieces.
We're still friends, right?
What?
Ah, I see. When I'm a ghost, you yell at me. Tell me to get lost. Say you'll find a way to kill me. Now I'm wearing the shell of an invincible wrecking machine and you want to be buddies again.
Yeah, pretty much, Holden replied.
Nah, we're good.
He punctuated the words with one last massive blow that shattered a 2-ton boulder into rubble. By hunching down on his 6 legs, Miller was able to squeeze through a small opening in the tunnel blockage. Holden lay down flat on the robot's back, a jagged piece of the tunnel roof passing less than 3 centimeters from his face.
Clear sailing from here, Miller said. But the maglev's dead after this. No more trains.
We have any better idea what we're looking for?
Only in general terms. About the time one-celled organisms on Earth were starting to think about maybe trying photosynthesis, something turned this whole damn planet off. Took it off the grid, and killed everything high enough up the food chain to have an opinion. If I'm right, the thing that did that's not entirely gone. Every time something reaches into this one particular place, it dies.
Sorry to hear that, Holden said.
Don't be, Miller said. It's what we're hoping for. Now buckle up. We're going to try to make up some lost time.
The robot bolted off down the tunnel, its 6 legs a blur of motion. Even moving at fairly high speed, the ride on its back was very smooth. Holden surprised himself by falling asleep again. He woke to something cold and rubbery touching his cheek.
Stop it, he said, waving one arm at the thing.
Wake up, Miller said, the detective's voice rumbling through the robot's carapace.
Shit.
Holden said, sitting up suddenly and wiping saliva off the side of his face. I'd forgotten I was here.
Yeah, I'd say a week of no sleep and too many amphetamines broke you a little, Miller said. You went on quite the bender.
Only without the fun.
I've been on a few myself, Miller said, and added a strange metallic laugh. None of them are fun. But we're about to hit the processing station. So get awake.
What should we be expecting?
I'll tell you when I see it, Miller said.
Holden pulled out his pistol and checked the magazine and chamber. It was ready to go. It felt a little like playing grown-up.
Anything that the Millerbot monstrosity couldn't handle wasn't going to be stopped by a few shots from his sidearm.
But, like so many things in life, when you come to the spot where you're supposed to do the rituals, you do them. Holden slid the pistol back into its holster but kept one hand on it. It took him a minute to see it, but a point of light appeared ahead in the tunnel and then grew. Not reflected light from the robot, but something glowing. Holden felt a rush of relief. He'd traveled longer and farther than he knew in the small metal tunnels of the transfer system. He was ready to go outside. The tunnel ended in a complex maze of new passages. A routing station, Holden guessed, where the arriving material was sent off to its various destinations. The walls were all of the same dull alloy as the tunnel. What machinery was visible in the cramped space was inset into the walls and flush with them. The Millerbot paused for a moment, its tentacles waving at the tunnel choices. Holden could picture Miller standing still at the junction, tapping one finger on his chin while he decided which path to take. And then, suddenly, he actually could see Miller overlapping the robot. The headache returned with a vengeance.
That one was kind of your fault, Miller said. It's an interactive system.
Do we have any idea where we're going?
Miller answered by trundling off down one of the many new tunnels. A few seconds later, They'd exited into a cavernous new space. It took Holden a few moments to realize that it was all still artificial. The room they entered felt too big to be a construct. It was like standing at the core of the world and looking up for the crust. All around stood vast, silent machines. Some were moving, twitching. They were recognizably designs that the protomolecule favored. They had the same half-mechanism, half-organic look of everything else he'd seen them build. Here, a massive system of tubes and pistons rising from a gantry twisting into whorls like a nautilus shell. There, an appendage coming from the ceiling, half again as long as the Rosinante and ending in a nine-fingered manipulating hand the size of Miller's robot. Light poured into the space, seemingly from everywhere at once, giving the air a gentle golden hue. The ground was vibrating. Holden could feel the soft pulses through the robot shell. "We're in a lot of trouble, aren't we?" Holden asked, breathless.
"Nah," Miller said, rotating the robot to test the air in every direction with its tentacles. "This is just initial material sorting and reclamation. Not even to the processing center. You could park a battleship in this room." "It's not for show," Miller said. Then the robot began scuttling toward a distant wall. "This is the point of this planet."
"Huh," Holden said. He found he was missing all of his other words.
"Huh. Yeah, so far as I can figure it, there are minerals native to this system that are fairly rare, galactically speaking."
"Lithium."
"That's one," Miller agreed. "This planet is a gas station. Process the ore, refine it, send it down to the power plants, then beam the collected energy out."
"To where?"
"To wherever. There are lots of worlds like this one, and they all fed the grid. Not the rings, though. I still don't know how they powered those."
The robot moved with machine speed toward a distant wall, and a section of the structure slid away. It left an opening the size of a repair shuttle, and more lighted machinery beyond. Some of the giant devices were moving with articulations more biological than mechanical. They pulsed, contracted, rippled. Nothing so prosaic and common as a gear or a wheel in sight.
"Are we moving through a fusion reactor right now?"
Holden asked, Naomi's question about radiation exposure on his mind.
"Nope, this is just ore processing. The reactors are all in that chain of islands on the other side of the world. These guys built for flexibility and redundancy."
"You know," Holden said, "one of the geologists told me this planet has been heavily modified. All of that was done just to turn it into a power station?"
"Why not? They didn't need it for anything else. Not a particularly good planet, rare metals aside. And be glad they did. You think you can have an underground rail system last 2 billion years on any planet with tectonic action?"
Holden was quiet for a moment, riding the Millerbot through the material refining plant as it throbbed around him.
"It's too much," he finally said. "That level of control over your environment is too much. I can't get my brain around it. What could kill these guys?"
"Something worse." The Millerbot ducked under what looked like a conveyor system made of metal mesh wrapped around a pulsing musculature. It was clicking and groaning as part of the mechanism tried to move while the rest of it remained frozen. Holden had a sudden, vivid memory of a goat he'd found as a child. It had one broken leg, wrapped in a barbed wire fence, the other three feebly pushing at the ground to set it free.
"So, there's the thing," the Millerbot said, waving its claws around at the machinery. "This right here was the point of this place. It's why this planet exists. And right around here, somewhere, is a blank spot in the planetary network. A place we can't touch.
So?
So, whatever's in that blank spot, it's not from around here. And if it's a bullet, then whoever did this knew to shoot for the heart.
Chapter 49. Havelock. Havelock moved across the surface of the Rocinante, magnetic boots clicking to the exterior plating, then lifting free again. To his right, the sun, a sun anyway, shone brighter than a welding torch. To his left, the great clouded curve of New Terra filled his personal sky, the planet looming in. The upper boundary of the exosphere was invisible if he looked down, the gases too thin for an imperfect human eye to make out. The vast, sweeping curve of it before and behind the ship was hardly more than a grayness against the void. It felt too close. It was too close. He could already imagine the vicious friction tearing away his suit, the ship, the thin air burning him worse than a belt sander. The angry, hot slag that had been one of the defense moons glowed high above, dull red against the pure white stars. His feet grabbed onto the plating, held, released. "How's it looking out there?" Naomi asked in his ear. "As well as could be expected. Kind of wish that planet wasn't quite so up in my face. I keep feeling like it's trying to pick a fight." "Yeah. I was thinking that too."
The point defense cannon was a single thick barrel on a hemispheric swivel joint, the metal smooth as a mirror. The hole at the end was a black dot small enough that Havelock could have blocked it with the tip of his ungloved pinky finger. The little tungsten slugs it spat out would have been small enough to hold in the palm of his hand, and the feed would have spat them out by the hundreds every second. It was a machine of inhuman power and sophistication, built to react faster than a human brain, and with enough force to shoot down anything that threatened the ship. Without power, he could use it to hide behind. He lay flat against the decking, just the toes of the mag boots engaged. He took the rifle off his back, synced it to the suit's HUD, and a handful of new stars appeared. Red for the militiamen, green for whatever the other things were they were hauling with them. The Rocinante bucked under him, the horizon of the ship shifting as the railgun fired. A half dozen streaks of blue danced from the defense moons above, marking the path of the railgun's round with the instantaneous violence of lightning. He shifted a few centimeters, correcting for the movement of the ship, reacquired his targets, and opened the general frequency.
"Gentlemen," he said, "this really isn't something we need to be doing."
He saw them respond, their bodies stiffening, their heads craning while they tried to look for him. No one came on the channel. He zoomed in on them. Their faceplates were darkened against the sun, making them anonymous. But he knew all of them.
"Honestly, why? What's this for? That ship down there and everyone on her is going to die. We're doing everything we can to put that off. But you guys have done the math, right? You have the same numbers we do. You don't gain anything from this. It's just being mean. You don't need to do that."
One of the dots flinched. At a guess, the chief engineer was shouting on whatever frequency they were all using now, drowning him out. Havelock let his sight drift to one of the other dots. The angle made it hard to parse exactly what he was seeing. A gas storage tube of some kind, with complications of wire and circuit board on either end. Some kind of improvised missile, he guessed. They would have been pointless if the PDC he was hiding behind had been working. He wondered whether the engineers knew the Rossi's defenses were down, or if they only guessed. or if the prospect of their own deaths and their hatred of the Belters had taken them far enough that the risk of being killed in order to deny the Barber Pecola a little more life seemed worth it to them. No matter what, it was disappointing. "Walters, is this how you want it to go down?"